Well, good morning, good afternoon if you're in Japan, or evening if you're watching it later tonight. Welcome. We've got if you want to know anything about Japanese craft beer or brewing, this is the place to be today, because I have with me Gareth Hunt from BEZ Brewing in, and I won't pronounce it properly, Aomori.
Yep, Aomori.
Aomori in Japan. Yep. He's the founder of the brewery, has a couple of tap rooms, and he's also the host of the Japan Craft Beer channel on YouTube. So this is the man to ask for any questions.
Yeah, I make my way around Japan, I think.
So, Gareth, thanks a million for taking part.
No worries.
I suppose the first thing to do is ask you, how did you end up owning a brewery in Japan?
So I've been in Japan since 2005. And okay. I originally came here with the U.S. military, got out, decided to stay what was supposed to be a year. And here we are, I don't know, 17, 18 years later. And about 8 or 9 years ago, you know, I kind of saw how craft beer was going in the States, and kind of knew it was going to go like that everywhere eventually. I don't really think craft beer is a trending thing or a fad. I think it's here to stay. And so about 8 years ago, started making plans to open up a brewery here, and opened up in 2016. And we've been going pretty busy ever since.
And was that because, like you said, you wanted to, I take it you were a brewer, you were homebrewing and stuff, or was it that purely a business venture that you were looking for a business?
I was homebrewing, and I mean, I always enjoyed, I think I drank a lot more craft beer before owning a brewery. And then, but I just, we're in a very rural area here. It's one of the less financial stable areas of Japan. It's kind of the countryside. There aren't a lot of jobs. Everyone, you know, graduates high school and either goes to college or leaves to go to Tokyo and find work. And so I thought making a brewery would help let me venture out in the creative side. It would also create local employment opportunities. And I think we would be ahead of the curve as far as when things started to take off in Japan. And it's been probably, even though with COVID and everything, I would say last year, this year, and probably next year, this is where it's hitting the huge growth spurt.
Okay.
Of a brewery opening every week, it seems like here.
Okay. Because, so maybe, I like I said, I looked at your YouTube channel, which everyone who has any interest in Japanese beer should check out, because you go around and you talk to all the other breweries and you're kind of getting to know them. And so I'm wondering, like, where is the scene? Because it looked to me like all the breweries, and maybe this is typical, maybe not, but they're all kind of small. Is that?
Yeah, I think just because of the size of Japan as a country, also, I think the drinking style here is much different. As far as like the amount that people drink, like it's when some Americans come through from the base or something, even if they're not like getting belligerently drunk, just the volume that they drink compared to Japanese people is very different. Okay. So something like a 10 hectoliter system in Europe or in America, you could sell a lot of that through your own tap room and maybe do some like cans or something like that, but you could kind of be self-sustained. But I would say a 10 hectoliter system here in Japan is medium to bigger sized.
Okay.
There's a few 17 hectoliter systems, and then you've got like a handful of people with like 40 hectoliters, but that's it. Like that's, and then you've got Asahi and Kirin and Sapporo and stuff like that.
Yeah, because it seemed to be, like I said, I've never been to Japan, so I better say that first. I mean, all my image of Japan is movies and books, you know. It's probably very cliched in many ways, but I'm very naive. So obviously space is a big factor in places like Tokyo, especially. I don't know about out in the country.
Well, I mean, really, space, I mean, even out here, it's technically cheaper, but they're still not the kind of space you're used to seeing in Western countries, where, I mean, you know, if you drive your car 30 minutes out of the city, then there's all the land you could ever want kind of thing. It's Japan, small as it is, and the land that they can use for building and stuff is even smaller. And so everything's pretty crammed tight, pretty compact. I mean, I don't even know how people fit 500 liter breweries in Tokyo. Like, it blows my mind when I go in, and it's basically like a hallway. Like, they've got a hallway almost. Yeah, it's crazy what they're doing. So, like,
that kind of fits in the, again, my naive understanding. Like, most of Japan, the businesses there are small family businesses. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's the big businesses, it's pretty common to go to, you know, anything from like a tofu shop to a car shop to something, and there'll be like a third or fourth generation person, family person running it. You know, their great great grandfather opened it, kind of thing. It used to surprise me a lot more, you know, when I'd hear like, oh wow, this place has been making traditional Japanese sweets for 115 years or something. But like, it's, I don't know, it's pretty common over here at this point for me. So
that's what I kind of understood. Like, so that means that the craft breweries, like you said, the small ones kind of fit into that scene, basically. They fit into the family business scene. They're not trying to take over the world. They're trying to be
they're just trying to fit into their community and meet needs that weren't met before. And it's interesting because, I mean, Japanese whiskey is very popular. Japanese wine is growing, and craft beer is growing now. But I would say before craft beer, before a lot of things, they've been making local sake here for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And so, like, there's nothing surprising about even small cities like we are having 5 or 6 sake breweries.
Okay.
But I think that's also because it's been going, you know, I think the youngest sake brewery in our city is 95 years old.
Okay.
And they're like a child in the sake brewing scene. So when you look at it like that aspect, I think, you know, with craft beer spreading and things like that, it's just kind of another step to kind of bring things back to more local, more centered on the community kind of thing.
And like, what is the craft beer drinker there? Because, again, I'm going to keep mentioning that I know nothing. But from outside, Japan seems to be, you know, like I said, it's the traditional. It has a huge traditional culture around the sake and around, you know, everything there, you know. And then it's also the future. And right. I don't know, are they two separate kind of communities? Does everybody kind of fit into both? And who then goes after craft beer? Who drinks craft beer?
I think, like most places, I think people borrow a lot from America. The brewing ideas, the brewing styles. I think right now, as far as Japan goes, we're finally on the downward slope of the hazy IPA boom and stuff like that. But it's definitely, opposed to being a lot more traditional Japanese-esque, I think it's a lot more mimicking and doing what breweries are doing in America.
Okay.
I would say that the people that are sticking to traditional Japanese ingredients or trying to do things Japanese-esque-wise are actually expats more than the Japanese. I don't. It's a weird thing. Like, it's, I don't know, maybe they just not take it for granted, but it's normal for them, so they don't think anything of it. But anytime I've seen unique Japanese ingredients or sake yeast or koji or matcha or yuzu or kokuto, which is a special black sugar from Okinawa, like, anytime I've seen most of that in beers, it's been breweries that expats are running. Yeah, so I think people, brewers and customers, need to get over the, oh wow, this smells so different than macro lager. It tastes so different. I think once they get past that, it'll kind of find their own way and start, right, you know, rebounding back to what actual Japanese flavor preferences and stuff like that are.
Okay, so yeah, so it's like you said, it is very young there.
People are sending our brewery emails even up to like a year and a half ago, because I got, I mean, I was old. I never wanted to do it, but I did it for a while. But like, I just don't get putting IBU on beers. I just think it's kind of stupid. And I don't see the point in it. And you know, even up to like a year and a half ago, we'd release beers and be like, oh, what's the IBU? And I'd be like, I don't know, a million, man. Like, it's just not that important. Yeah. Like, it's, but so like, but when you look back at, you know, IPAs in the early 2000s in America, like that was a big thing, like 90 IBU IP, and like, and it was just like, you know, it was because nobody knew what an IBU was. And like, and so it's kind of like that, where it's just kind of a little bit older.
So that sounds like, I mean, it is going to be perfect for Japan once the kind of the pendulum swings back to where it is everywhere else, and it everywhere else seems to be going more like traditional. There's, you know, saisons and kind of using traditional ingredients and trying to be more local. So it sounds like Japan could be a major powerhouse when it kind of settles down a bit.
I think so. I think once, you know, once you get over the shock and awe of it not being Asahi Super Dry, then you can only go that way, right? Like,
you have to rebel first and then settle down.
You can't drink 9% hazy IPAs for the rest of your life. You just can't do it. It's just not feasible.
So is that what everyone that, like you said, it's mainly that's what the kind of the craft is there, but
it's
sorry, go on.
No, it's the driving force here. Like, we'll, you know, we release two or three new beers every week, and our hazies will sell out kegs and cans in, you know, about an hour or so. But recently I released a apple basil saison, where I used fresh basil in the whirlpool. 70% of it was wort, 30% of it was apple juice. And then I dry hopped with roasted apples that I left the skin on, and it was kind of like a product of love. It's a very super interesting beer, but nobody wants to buy it, so got to get back to cranking out the fruit juice.
I mean, that's the same thing. The only thing is, I suppose, like you said, if it's a small, you know, small areas, you can produce experimental batches that you don't have to sell straight away, do you?
Yeah, no, I mean, when I say it doesn't sell, I mean, the beer will be around for maybe a month and a half or something.
Okay.
But we don't, I don't like, our beers aren't pasteurized, they aren't filtered. So our DO levels are under 50 PBB, but still, I would rather the beer be gone quicker than later. Right. I mean, not only for obvious financial reasons, but just because.
Second, we've lost your sound.
Oh, sorry about that. The copying machine next to me is going off, so I muted it to try to smooth things out. I don't remember what I was just saying.
No, you were just saying about you prefer people to drink it fresh and to.
Yeah. It's just so, you know, it's nice to get the beers out there after they're made, when they're in their best condition, kind of thing. Right. But luckily, moving beer around Japan is super easy. There aren't any strict laws or state-to-state stuff like America or other places. It's we have the local post office basically come by every day at 4, and they just load up a refrigerated truck and take it around Japan for us.
All right, refrigerated and all from the post office.
Yep. So it's our beer, ideally, is from the time it leaves the tank to hits the glass, has been refrigerated the whole time. So.
Okay, that is some post office service. We wouldn't get that here. so that brings, like, where do you sell your beer? Because you have two tap rooms, do you?
Yeah, so we have two tap rooms. So we were a keg only brewery up until COVID, and obviously that wasn't going to last. So we scrambled and we bottled for about a year and then got a canning line. But we sell a majority of our beer to Tokyo. That's where a lot of the craft beer drinkers are. A lot of the people are in Japan. But we sell our beer throughout the whole country, every single prefecture, whether it's kegs going to craft beer bars and restaurants, or if it's cans going to supermarkets or select shops or liquor stores, or we sell stuff online here from out right out of our brewery. And between our two tap rooms, we have customers swing in and grab packs of beer and stuff like that. So it's I would say locally within our area, we sell about 30-40% of our beer maybe. And then the rest is throughout all of Japan.
Yeah, that sounds a good solid base locally to kind of base everything else around. And are cans, is there any preference for cans or bottles over there, or do people care?
It's cans are relatively new here. I think there's still more breweries bottling than canning. You still get, I've run into a few people that we want to buy your beer, but we can't, you know, have it in cans. Canned beer has a cheap image. And it's just like, come on, man, it's not 1993. Like, there's no reason other than if you're doing like a big barrel aged stout or a special sour beer or something that you kind of want to display the uniqueness of it in a bottle. Other than that, there's absolutely no reason to bottle beer over cans. Like, it's that debate died a long time ago. So I just tell them, okay, see you in 8 months when you're like, oh, you know what? It seems like everybody's and like, yeah, it's what I tried to tell you, but you're over here telling me I should be bottling my beer. So yeah, I'll wait till you figure it out. Like,
nice to be in that position.
Just like, I'm too busy to try to explain to each and everybody like how cans are superior to bottles. So.
Right. Yeah. No, but I think it's the same. It's the same everywhere. I've spoken to, like, cans have a resistance at first, and then suddenly the customer demands them.
No, we sell other people's beers from here and there, and you know, to help out other breweries. And like, there were some points where I just didn't want to order beer because it was in bottles. I was like, that's such a pain. Like, I just don't want a shelf of bottled beer in my fridge. And we, like, special cardboard boxes, or like, nah, it's just, no, nope, it's gone. It's a thing of the past. Like, which is funny because, you know, craft beer was special because it was, you know, fancy bottles and stuff for a while there. And like, cheap beer was in cans and good beer was in bottles. But now it's, I mean,
Now, like you say, there is an aesthetic to the bottle though, that, like you said, for the barrel aged stouts and all.
Oh, absolutely.
And I can understand a restaurant, a high end restaurant, not wanting cans because they don't want to, you know, a bottle looks nicer on the table. But other than that, yeah, it seems to have taken over. But you mentioned there that you sell like other breweries' beers, and like I said, from your YouTube channel, it looks like it's a very tight, very helpful scene there. That all the breweries are kind of, they know each other and are very helpful. Or is there a lot of competition?
I don't think the competition has set in yet. I think there's still a lot of, everyone's really friendly. Everybody's trying to do what they can do, but it's everyone really helps them people out here. I know because we were a keg only brewery and COVID hit. So we started bottling, and we had quite a few people reach out, other breweries reach out and say like, oh, we're going to do like a special mixed brewery set. So we want to, you know, buy a bunch of cases of your beer, and like, and so it's, everyone really, really helps each other out. And ideally it wouldn't get too competitive for a while. I don't know if we'll have the chance to get competitive with how good the big breweries here are at cinching down on craft beer. So Asahi, Sapporo Kirin, like, they changed the laws. They're basically just doing everything to make sure that they can continue to do what they do and craft beer doesn't expand, kind of thing. So it's a bit scary. Like, I think it's more difficult now to open a brewery than when we did. Like, the licenses changed and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I think within the craft beer community, everyone seems to get on pretty well. And I mean, it's like I said, it's a small country. We're all going to run into each other now and then. So you can't. Good luck burning a bunch of bridges. Like, I don't think there's that many to burn, honestly. Like, burn one or two, and then that's it.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, I think it's the same. Most places, like, the craft beer is still only a tiny percentage of the overall market. So you're not competing against each other. You're competing against the overall market, really.
Yeah, like, I just don't get it. I mean, I mean, yeah, I guess everyone has ideas of what they want to do and make a bigger brewery. And our brewery is maxed out. I can't put any more tanks in it. Our production is topped out, and I'm just, that's fine. I'm just going to ride this out until right. the end of days. Like, but that's me. Like, you know, some people would be going to the bank and getting ready for the next big expansion, et cetera, et cetera. And then once you expand, you have to sell beer. And
yeah,
and I get that, but I'm good. Like, we're in a comfortable position finally. And, don't want to rock the boat too much.
But you seem to be doing a lot. I mean, you, if I, again, just from your website and that, I mean, you're now got a little farm or something as well that you're kind of doing, which surprised me, like, you're within a country the size of Japan, that you're doing an almost complete cycle brewery in many ways.
Oh yeah. Like, that was pretty early on. I mean, you know, I've got a whole list of things I want to do and would love to do, but, you know, implementing them and finding the right timing for them. But our farm, we have our hops out there, and that lets us do our fresh hop beer every year. And then we grow quite a bit of vegetables and stuff that we use in our tap rooms, and just try to keep it as local as we can, or, you know, keep our carbon footprint down. And honestly, it's just better. Like, it's just better when you grow your own potatoes and you dig them out of the ground and you bring them here and wash them up and serve them in food. It's just, it's the quality is better. And, you know, it's a good story to tell. I think it's rewarding. A lot of the staff and stuff was pretty hesitant to it. But then, you know, once you see it and once you see people's reaction to it, it just makes, it's definitely the way it's supposed to be done, I think, but it's a lot of hard work. So
yeah,
it's a lot of hard work.
So just asking for more stuff. So in your tap room, is it all regulars? Sorry, not locals, but regulars. Or do you get, like, are you seeing new people in there? Or
we get lots of, we have like a big following locally, but we also we were bigger outside of our local area before we were big locally, okay. Which I think is not the norm. Usually it goes like this, but like we kind of skipped everything and kind of blew up in Tokyo and Osaka and stuff. And we had, for the first year, we had more people coming from outside of our area, like making the trip all the way up here because they had our beer in Tokyo. And I mean, for the first year or two in this local area, they didn't know what craft beer was. So they would just say Gareth's beer. They would just call it my beer. And I'd have to tell them, like, I didn't invent this. Like, it's my beer, but like there's, like, I saw another company of the Gareth's beer. It's like, it's definitely not Gareth's beer at that point. Like, we had a bit of a jet lag locally. But I mean, it was never really that dead. It's just people didn't really get the whole concept behind it. But, you know, of course, everywhere it's gotten all thrown out of whack with COVID and everything. But like, it's coming back. And, you know, we've had local people since day one. And we have people that, you know, make yearly trips or whatever. And we also do events down in the big cities and stuff. And so we have a decent enough following. So as long as people are enjoying the beer, it's okay. Like,
right, that's the goal. You're officially the Xerox of Japanese craft beer then.
Yeah. This is Gareth's. You see this? Who makes this Gareth's beer? Like, I don't know, but it's probably the guy's name. It's not Gareth's beer at this point.
Sorry, it's just, yeah, that's a bit much. But can I ask you about sake? So, because obviously, like I said, there's loads of sake breweries, and is there any sort of crossover between people doing that, or is there any?
We are very lucky. I think some other craft breweries are lucky to be near some sake breweries that are a little bit more flexible. Sake breweries have been brewing sake in a certain way with a certain mindset for a very, very, very long time. So this whole radical idea of, you know, throw whatever you want in it and let's shoot from the hip and what would happen if we did this, it's just not really part of their DNA.
Okay.
So there are some crossovers. We're lucky because our local sake, one of our local sake breweries, they make koji for us. So we'll ask them, can you make, like, so Japanese sake uses yellow koji, and they're always making that, so we can always take some of that. But they also make white koji for us if we need it, which is never used in sake. They also, we've used a few different sake yeasts and stuff like that. And, you know, when I've used the yeasts, the sake yeasts, they only, they're only really good at fermenting glucose. So when you put it in wort, it has a lot harder time. And so as far as with us, we have a really good relationship with the sake brewery. And I know there's a few others around here and there, but there's also sake breweries that just won't even let like people see inside. Like they're going to steal the secrets or I don't know. Like, yeah, it's a very traditional world, I guess, is the best way to put it. So,
and is it widely drunk there? I would never have a good picture of like,
or whether it's I think so.
Okay. Is it date maybe or like?
I think sake is more of a special occasion kind of thing. Okay. Like it is drunk and it's not like extremely expensive, but it's just not, I don't think it's so much of a daily drink as it is a New Year's drink or a summer holiday drink or,
okay.
I mean, you'll drink it when you're having traditional Japanese food. But, I mean, if you go anywhere outside of that, if you go to a bar, Italian restaurant or something, like, it's not, you're not going to find it there. Like, they have sake bars, sake-specific bars and stuff. But I think it's not as, I think there's going to be more canned whiskey sours and stuff like that in people's fridges than there are sake bottles, probably.
Yeah, because I had no clue. Again, you know, Japanese restaurants, you get it and you drink it, but that's it, you know. But I did see, what was it, David Beck, or what was it, Brooklyn Beckham is fronting some big sake thing, so I was wondering whether there's a big push for it or whether it was popular in Japan as a daily drink, because they seem to be doing it in cans, and I don't know, it was Beckham, so.
Yeah. No, I think, I think it's actually like in a good way, it's not really thought about, like it's just normal, it's just,
yeah,
like, and that's not like taking anything away from it, but like there's a lot of foreign country, there's some places in foreign countries that are starting to make sake or attempting at it, and we've seen it, and I've had some from, I think it was France or something, and it was okay, but like the standard over here is obviously very right. High, but it's not like the craft beer thing where it's about rarity or lining up to buy it or, you know, untapped scores. It's just like, oh, you've got a bottle of sake. Okay, let's drink it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's good. Like in the best way possible. It's like no weird things going on. It's
just no IBUs listed on it or anything.
No.
So now I know you kind of have a limited amount of time. So where do you think the scene is going in there in Japan?
Because
from what it sounds like, it's so far a couple of years behind, say the US, and it's still on the hazy IPAs. But it like we said, that'll change. So if that changes, what does Japan look like then?
I think it's going to get a little. There's going to be some growing pains here, in the next year or so, just because. The one unfortunate thing about brewing beer in Japan is there's no literature. There's no way to really gain information in Japanese. There's no brewing school in Japan. Okay. There's no, you know, I could Google how to brew hazy IPA with peach, and it's some website or some homebrew site or something's going to give me at least some insight into it. Whereas in Japan and Japanese, they don't have that. So I think there's a lot of new breweries opening up, and their goal is to open breweries opposed to making good beer. Okay. And those are two very different things, in my opinion. Anybody with debt or money can open up a brewery. doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be making good beer. And so I think the rush to open up breweries might, you know, kind of give it a dip in quality, but then it'll work itself out. And, you know, the customers will figure it out pretty quickly. Yeah. Like, and little by little, I think, you know, each town, each city will have, you know, 2 or 3 or 4, 5 craft breweries, just like everywhere else is getting to, and small breweries that you can go to. And I don't see any big breweries ever, big craft breweries, you know, like America's Stone or Rogue. Like, it's just Japan's too small for that kind of thing. So I think from now it's going to be a lot more 300 to maybe 1,000 liter breweries just popping up all over Japan. And hopefully they'll become an integral part of their community.
Right. And actually, that brings me back, because you mentioned Asahi and that they're kind of trying to make it difficult for people to open breweries. Are they doing any of the thing that you see the big brewers do elsewhere and set up their own craft brands and try and...
Oh, yeah. They're really good at it. I mean, and customers here don't know any better, unfortunately. You know, you've got Kirin Craft. It says craft beer on the can. You've got Suntory Craft Beer. Just 2 years ago, so there's two different, it takes a while to explain, but there's a thing called beer here, and then they have a special term here. It's basically like almost like malt liquor, but it's not malt liquor. It's something different. It's like, so if you use any adjuncts or anything, basically it's like their beer is based off the German purity law.
Okay.
So if you add something into that outside of it, it's not considered beer anymore. It's not like cheap malt liquor. It's this weird Japanese thing. And to get a beer license, you have to be able to produce 60,000 liters a year, which is a lot for these smaller places. To get this quasi beer license, you only need to produce 6,000. And so what they did at first during the micro beer boom in the 90s is they made the law that way because that quasi beer was kind of looked down on.
Okay.
And so no one wanted to buy. But now, I mean, I would say the majority of craft beer made in the world falls under if it came to Japan, because, you know, sour beers, they have fruit in it. You've got beers with wood. You've got all these different kinds of things. And technically, by Japanese law, they're not beer. They're quasi beer. And so what they did 2 years ago is they changed it somehow. The beer license, which only the big guys have, that tax is cheaper. And so now all of the people opening these small places that get that quasi beer license that produce 1/10 of it, their tax is higher.
Jeez.
Yeah, and because it's not beer, recently I heard that in some areas they're fighting people putting styles on cans, like if it says porter, because porter is a beer, and you're making a quasi beer, so you can't call it a porter. And so they're just doing what they can to you know, keep their corporate conglomerate oiled machine running. So it's. Everyone deals with their own things here. I think Kirin's the most aggressive. It's not so much Asahi or Sapporo. Kirin is, like, it's almost impressive at times. Like, I think they just have this think tank of people sitting around, like, how do we combat this new threat? Like, it's amazing what they come up with. So just gotta play ball. It's on their field kind of thing. So
I haven't released any yet with a, like, Kirin Garrett spear on it.
Yeah, I wish. I already told it, because when the thing came up about them not being able to put porter on it, I already have my, if they ever come to me and say that for whatever reason, I'm just going to add an extra letter on there, because it's Japan. It's not, English isn't the main language. So I'll spell porter with 2 R's. I'll spell I'll spell stout with 2 T's at the end. Just be like, well, no, it's a different word. Like, you want to play games? I can play games as well. Like, let's.
So outside of Japan, I mean, you just back from New Zealand, weren't you?
Yeah. So give me one sec before my computer dies. One sec.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I went down to Nelson in New Zealand and checked out a bunch of hop farms. and went to what I think is one of the best hop producers currently, Freestyle Hops from New Zealand. And I went and checked out their process and talked with them and rubbed a lot of hops and did some hop selection and put in a pretty big order for their hops coming up this following year.
And is that something you do a lot? Like, you don't go through the big, like when you're getting your ingredients, is it a, do you do a lot of direct or like?
No. So this is our first, because we're all relatively small on the grand scale of things, we actually have kind of like a co-op going here between four or five of us so that we can get up to a certain number to where we'll kind of get recognized kind of thing. It's always been something I wanted to do. It just, it hadn't come to the light, but this year we're focusing on New Zealand this year and next year. And then we'll slowly, hopefully try to get focused on America and stuff as well. Cause they have suppliers here that import products. The problem is none of them are brewery or beer related companies. They're like one of them. It's like a division of a huge thing. So they import coffee, they import liquors, they import flour, they import sugar, and they import hops. Right. And so, it's, you know, a vanilla bean is a vanilla bean is a vanilla bean until you realize that it's not. And you're like, you know what? I want the juiciest, slimiest, sweatiest looking, but just oozing vanilla bean. That's what I want. And so, and that's what we're getting with the Freestyle Hops. And hopefully at some point we can do something similar with America. And, but the hops they're making are, it's just, they're too good, especially for the current beer trend where, you know, everyone wants to drink fruit juice. So it helps. It helps a lot.
Right. So yeah, so everything there, sorry, I'm just going to come back. Everything there is imported nearly, is it? All the ingredients. So
everything. We use for our malt, the majority of our malt is English Simpson's malt. Little expensive, but as far as like the crystal malts and specialty malts go, in my opinion, I don't think there's many that can come close to it. And then we use some best malts and some Irex, two German maltsters. And then hops, mostly America, New Zealand, every once in a while some German stuff, and then and I mean yeast as well, it's all imported kind of thing. So yeah, there's no malting done in Japan. They grow hops here. I think Sapporo and them, they have hop fields, but I think they just grow stuff for like bittering. Like there's no actual hop projects here or anything like that. So yeah, everything basically everything is imported.
Right. So. And that's all, like you said, through big conglomerates. So it's kind of hard to get specific stuff.
Yeah, it's hard to get specific stuff. Depending on your size, it's hard to get the good stuff. Like they're, when fresh bags come in, they don't go to the guy that's buying 100 kilograms a month. And so Trish trying to find ways around that, like same with malt and stuff, like that we're trying to get together and just fill containers for us. And right. I mean, it's a lot less to do with like undercutting someone or taking out the middleman opposed to just, we want the best ingredients. Like I'll buy it even at a raised price from anybody. But you know, like a lot of the times here you get it's a lot of places, but you get a bag of Citra and you don't know if it's going to smell like passion fruit or tortilla chips. And like, I can't be paying, $65 American for a 5 kilogram bag of tortilla chip Citra. Like, it's just not how it goes.
Is that something you could see happening, that like more specialist kind of?
I think so. Because you know, the smaller you are as any business, the more flexible you can be and the more fluid you can be. It's really hard to turn a big ship kind of thing. And so hopefully, I mean, I hope just for my sake and for our customers' sakes that a few places pop up here and there, and then maybe the main people will kind of get woken up and like, oh wait, we can't just move stuff from A to B anymore. We actually have to put thought into what we're doing. And oh, well, nobody wants our tortilla citra anymore. I guess we better contract better citra. Like, yeah. So like, I mean, ideally, hopefully, like, because when that happens, everyone benefits. The brewers benefit, the customers benefit. Like, so I hope little by little. It's just things like that. It's Japan is super strict when it comes to food things.
Okay.
Anything food related, anything import, like it's so. I mean, if I would never attempt to do it, like just the process seems very grueling. So if someone else wants to do it, I'll gladly support you. But
okay. So listen, I'm going to have to let you go soon because I know you have other things to do. Is there anything that I should have asked you there that maybe you said someone outside of Japan would suddenly want to know and you'll say, oh, God, we've missed an opportunity to tell them?
I don't think so. Just, I mean, all the information's out pretty accessible now. So, you know, if you come to visit Japan, if you're in Tokyo or Osaka, just even in English, Google Maps, put in craft beer.
Right.
And, you know, some places are going to come up, some breweries will pop up, and go check it out. I encourage people to try some of the more unique beers made here. You know, there's some people making beers with bonito flakes. I'm not a big fan of it, but it's like a Japanese seasoning type of thing. Okay. And it might not be a lot of foreigners' cup of tea, but I think it's a nice insight to see that there are a lot of other things in Japan other than yuzu and matcha. So,
yeah, well, hopefully, like you said, as people, maybe as Japanese people themselves, Japanese brewers themselves kind of get past the hazy phase, they might start experimenting and kind of bringing out the local flavors. And
I hope so. Anything but yuzu and matcha, anything but.
Actually, before I let you go, one question on that. So is there a lot of Japanese beers exported, do you think? Craft beers, or is it all with staying within the country?
No, and I don't think it's really possible. I want to say we have some of the highest alcohol tax in the world. I don't know what it is for other countries. I know for America, for example, I think a gallon, depending on where you live, is, you know, between what, 20 to 30 cents for a gallon. A gallon's 4 liters. Here in Japan, we pay $2.20 a liter. So that's $8.80. Again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, all of the ingredients are imported.
Yeah.
So like we're paying more for the same malt. We're paying more for the same hops. We're paying more for tax. Also, Japan is mostly just Japanese people. So there's not a lot of immigrant workers here. So the average salary is a lot higher. And so like, I just think it's feasible to, you know, even with something like matcha, to make a matcha IPA, send it to California, send it to Europe, and then expect people to pay $10 a bottle for it when you could buy something in country. Like, it's just not,
okay.
I don't really think it's a feasible thing logistically wise. Like, yeah. So
we have to make those Benito. I'll have to go over there to get the Benito one. So
yeah. I mean, if you skipped out on it, I wouldn't say you're missing much, but like, I'm not a big fan of it, but it is nice to see like something that you probably wouldn't be able to see back home kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, beer tourism, at least that sense of, you know, you go somewhere and you want the local beers and you want the thing that sells. It's a way of just kind of discovering another side of a country, really.
Yeah. It's a culinary experience, right? Like, you do it with food, you do it with desserts, and you do it with wine, you do it with it. So it's just beer is finally caught up to the rest of the culinary world, basically.
So like I said, I would look forward to the ones coming from Japan, giving its culinary traditions, but it sounds like I won't be seeing them though.
You'll have to swing on by here. We'll have plenty of beers ready for you.
All right, listen, Garrett, thanks a million for the time. I know you have to go on that, but it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Brian.
So that's it. Basically, I'm running out of words there. Thanks a million. I'm just going to play out this thing, and we'll say bye-bye.
All right. Cheers.